Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 16. On this week's episode, we are going to continue our segment of the Disney Movie Hour, and this week we're going to feature Fantasia. So, to my left, as always, is Brian. Say hello, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
Across from me is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
And to my right is Scott. Say hello, Scott.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. The Trouble by Pogo, and you can find his music over on soundcloud.com/pogomix, the videos for his music over on youtube.com/pogo, and his home address is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at our new Disney Twitter handle, which is Diz Magic Hour Pod. And over on Facebook, you can find us. We have a little group. Again, just search for Disney Magic Hour, and that'll bring you to there. And then find us on iTunes. And if you could, please, as we had two people do this week, and I'm going to read them at the end. Someone remind me of that, please.
Okay, yes, definitely.
Head on over to iTunes, hit that subscribe, and please give us a 5-star review. It really helps with getting that show to pop up on more searches and whatnot. So, and also just sharing the page, sharing the show on your page, telling your friends. We've met a lot of people who have actually gotten it through other people. So that's been really, really helpful so far. So anyways, how is everybody?
Very good.
Good. Doing good.
Good. Scott, good. Good.
Yep.
We got some weather going on finally. We haven't had weather, I feel like, in months.
Yeah, no, it's we haven't had anything.
Yeah, so there is a lightning and a thunderstorm. So if by some weird chance you might hear like an odd break if the power was to go out, but I will try to edit it out anyway as best as I can if that occurs. But we, you know, obviously we won't know that. So, this week we're going to continue on our merry little quest of reviewing every Disney animated film and some live actions that have effects on the park. It's like a weird little asterisk I got to throw in there every time. And this week we are going to look at 1940s Fantasia. Spoiler alert, this is my favorite Disney film.
Yeah, I was going to repost our favorite Disney films, but then it was in the film basement, and I was like, I don't know if I should share that on our Twitter page, since it's like the film basement one, and that's definitely adult.
Yeah, I don't want someone to stumble upon some other stuff if they don't really want to get into that. That's why we made the separate Twitter.
No, I know. I was just saying that was like our intro to our favorite Disney films. We haven't really mentioned them here, but if anybody listened to that, they would know Sorcerer Mickey's your guest.
Yeah, it's like we did one of the most obvious shows, but we did it on another show, and I'm sure that one of the participants in that show make it an explicit show.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, because it wasn't just us. It was one of our film basement guys. So we'll never actually get that. But full disclosure, Fantasia is my favorite film, but I will say it is not my favorite animated film of all time, and we will get into that because there is something of this film that doesn't work for me. There is one aspect, so we'll get to that. But Scott, how familiar were you with Fantasia before doing this? It's a movie that I feel a lot of people have not watched.
Yeah, I was familiar with it, but I don't think I've watched it from start to finish. I've, familiar with the segments that they have, certain ones, but it was good to see, it in its entirety. So
nice. Same with Brian.
Yeah, I haven't, I haven't really watched it in a really long time. Probably since that Fantasia and Fantasia 2000 Blu-ray came out.
Okay, yeah,
that's probably the last time that I watched it. Of course, there's some the Sorcerer's Apprentice is one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
So that scene I'm very familiar with, and Bald Mountain. But other than that, I really kind of forgot what the other scenes were about until we watched it. And it was funny because there's the one scene with when we get to it, with the dancing
hippos.
The hippos and the crocodiles, and they're in I think it's Twice Upon a Christmas. There's a segment in that. Yeah. There's a bunch of little Christmas short parts, but they have the dancing.
Yeah, it's Minnie versus Daisy, and they're like having a
and one of them has the crocodiles, and one of them has the.
I'm pretty sure that the hippos make an appearance in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
When they're outside of the film studio, I'm pretty sure that one of them makes an appearance. So, Melissa, same question. We watched it over two nights.
Yes.
Because we had a couple of long days. But prior to that, have you ever sat down and watched the full original?
Yeah. I mean, when we rewatched it recently, nothing in there was I don't remember that happening.
Even the music? I thought some of the music was like, oh, it's that?
No, and the music is very, very familiar just because they're classical songs, which I tend to, you know, listen to at work a lot. So, yeah, nothing was really surprising, and I felt like I remembered a large part of it. I didn't really have a part where I was like, oh, I don't remember that, as I had with Pinocchio and Snow White.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of Fantasia 2000 in that your previous
probably
comments.
Probably more, yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking of then. So we're not going to go crazy into the history of Fantasia, because that wouldn't be an episode. That would be a whole separate podcast. I will one day eventually do a supplemental show that is nothing but like the making of Fantasia. But if we did this now, the show would be really, really long, and I still wouldn't really scratch the surface, because I am missing one very important book in my collection that would help bring everything together. You know the one I'm talking about. All of a sudden, I'm blanking on the title.
Oh, I was hoping you would remember, because I was that's the one that Pete always wants.
I wrote it. You know what? I have it down in my show notes for another one. I will look it up eventually when someone else is talking a lot. And
well, I mean, a good supplement also to the Fantasia was with that combo Blu-ray, the Fantasia 2000, was a making of documentary, and that was very long documentary. It went really into detail. I'll mention some of the stuff that I remember from it, because we had watched it after we got the Blu-ray, and there were some very cool techniques that they used that obviously wouldn't be used again, but it's just really interesting, because this was really, you know, still the start of the animation and how to, you know, develop the techniques that they would use. And when we go through some of the segments, you know, some of the stuff that had been used in Pinocchio, I felt like came up again. And then some of the newer stuff that they were working with Fantasia, I felt like bled into some of the other movies. So
yeah, the special effects in this film are really remarkable when you remember when it was made.
Yeah, that's the thing.
The techniques that had to go into it. And thank you for that monologue. It was The Lost Notebook, Herman Schultheis, and the Secrets of Walt Disney's Movie Magic. It's a long title.
That's the title?
That's the title. It's by John Kanemaker. He put the collection together. We've referred to Schultheis in a previous show. I don't remember which one, but a lot of the secrets that they thought were lost on technique of how they achieve these effects are in his notebook, which was found, I believe, by his widow after his passing.
Oh, wow.
And then she, you know, basically gave it to Disney, and they were like, wow, okay, we can do this. And actually, if I remember correctly, they made an interactive version of this at the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, you can, like, go through it digitally on a panel and, you know, highlight certain sequences. Very akin to the animated app that Disney has out. And if you've never checked that out, if you have an iPad device, because I believe it's iOS.
It's iPad, yeah.
It's iPad iOS.
I believe it's iPad iOS, yeah.
It's well worth the investment. It's a really gorgeous app, and you can get a lot of fun little clips and everything like that. But a little bit of background on the film. This obviously is a huge departure from the first two Disney films, in that this was originally called the concert film. They obviously changed it to Fantasia, which Steve Martin riffs on in Fantasia 2000, that we're all happy they made that change. You can make an obvious guess that audiences did not know how to react to this. This was not what they were expecting, even though you would think a lot of people would say, oh, well, okay, it's just like silly symphonies.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they were just waiting for someone to talk. And obviously the first sequence is just abstract.
Yeah.
So it can be off-putting. You know, you're going to see a Disney film and you don't see any animation until 7.5 or so minutes into it. I actually wrote that down.
It's a while.
It's 7 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
That's including the opening introductions and all that. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, a little weird for people. So it didn't get overly well received, and the development of Fantasound, which in the simplest terms is your first surround sound, that Disney bought into, that cost them a ton of money because they had to install that into theaters in order to, you know, to have that. It's just brand new stuff. It was stereophonic surround system in 1940.
Yeah, and actually, because it was such a new technology, they could only do a limited release in certain theaters for it. And then, since it really wasn't, you know, being shared, I guess is the best word I can come up with for that, they actually cut the film down to 88 minutes and did a wider release of it in regular theaters.
Yeah, there's been multiple cuts. And you know what? I'm going to talk about a very controversial cut. I just want to talk about it now and get it over with, because if I don't bring it up, I feel like it'll be weird, but I don't want to focus on it too much because I don't want to use the term "it was a different time," but it was a different time. And even then, this sequence was like, hey, that's a bit much, isn't it, folks? And that is in the sequence, the Pastoral Symphony. They did edit out a black centaur who was nappy-headed, you know, big-lipped, and was shining the hoofs of a white girl centaur. Now, they didn't cut it as in, like, it's not in there anymore. What they've done is they zoomed in on that shot. So you see the girl centaur looking at something very distinctly, like, below her, but you never know what she's looking at because they worked around that. You can find it on YouTube if you're really curious to see what it looked like. It's not good. But I hate to say it, but that was kind of the temperament of the country. That wasn't something that was controversial then.
Well,
it just wasn't. It shows we've made at least some progress, thank God.
Yeah.
So it's presented in 4:3, which I still find very interesting until we get to Sleeping Beauty, I think.
I think that was the first
widescreen film that they ever do.
I think
so. So it's interesting watching anything in 4:3 because you really don't get that anymore nowadays. Even if you've watched something on DVD, maybe 4:3, it could have been cropped. A recent-ish, within the last 20 years, film that was 4:3 actually was Spielberg's AI. But that was a very like, oh, wow, someone's doing that? So let's talk about how we open up. We basically open up on a blue-black drop, and we have the orchestra setting up, and Deems Taylor is our host. Mm-hmm. And this was also something that must have thrown some people off. Like, we have a host, and he's talking to us, and he has such a distinct voice also.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's nothing else his voice could remind me of beyond Fantasia. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he did other stuff, but that was all. No, I actually didn't look it up. I did not look it up. Again, I tried to hold back from the rabbit hole that would have been the research. Yeah. Actually, you know, one other little piece of research. The budget of this film was $2.5 million, which to that era was about 4.5 times the rate of a motion picture.
Yeah. Wow.
It did not do well at first, but over time it has made $76 million, according to Box Office Mojo. So
I did get a date on that. It was only after 1963 that it actually started to go back into the black.
Because of the re-release.
It was
a very like hippie loved film that it was around same time. Yeah, it was around the same time like Alice got big again.
Well, it just seems like after they released it like two times, that's when the film started to kind of get popular. For lack of a word.
Okay, well, I'm curious what era those films were released the second time. Were a lot of them in the 60s?
Well, this one in particular was. It was 1963, the second release of it.
Okay.
Well, no, it would be the third, because they released it one time before. So it would be like the original release, another release, and then this one, which is when it finally started getting returns.
And it was supposed to be a project that would keep coming up,
yeah,
which they speak about in Fantasia 2000. It was supposed to be, you know, Fantasia would just always be the title. You would get some new sequences, some old sequences. And I really, it's kind of bummy that they've never done anything since Fantasia 2000. It did so well also on the IMAX screen. That was one of the first regular films I went to go see on an IMAX screen. Mm-hmm. You know, I traveled all the way into the city to see that by myself, I want to say, I think. And I wish they would do something like this again.
Yeah, I would love that.
Yeah.
And this, like you said, it's such a perfect vehicle. Just call Fantasia and you just update it every, you know, add new sequences every so many years.
But Scott, do you think like a modern audience could, I guess, you know what? Let me take that question back because we're going to get to that later, right?
Yeah.
That's one of our best
questions. I was going to say that's kind of the end, yeah. All right.
So let's go in. So we meet Deems Taylor and we get introduced and he basically describes what you're going to be watching and he refers to it as, was it three different types of music?
Yes.
What was that, Melissa?
It was music that tells a definite story with no specific plot lines. Then there's absolute music, which is kind of the first sequence that it's almost, you could think of it like abstract art. It's just there. It paints pictures.
He says music for its own sake.
Right.
Yeah. The second one is the no specific plot, but it gives you images in your head, possibly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the third one is the absolute music. Like the abstract one. I went a little out of order in my notes. Sorry.
It was a definite story is one of them. And then no specific plot, but gives you a definite idea of pictures in your head.
Yeah.
And then third one, which segues into our first sequence, is music that exists for its own sake.
Yeah, he called that absolute music. And I always just thought of it like abstract art.
And that would be our integration into Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Bach. And this really kind of shows off a lot of cinematography, like classic cinematography with lighting and whatnot, using Leopold Stokowski, which I can't help. Anytime I hear Leopold Stokowski, I think of the Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny cartoon where he dresses like Leopold and he's walking. Do you remember this at all?
No.
He's walking up the thing and everyone's like, Leopold, Leopold, Leopold. He doesn't. You remember that? He got the opera singer and he's like torturing the opera singer.
No, I don't remember that.
Oh,
one.
I got it. All right, we'll watch it after. Okay. That and The Rabbit of Seville, because we're going to bring that up later too. So much to talk about.
Yeah.
So we get this. It starts. I felt like it starts like a sunrise.
Yeah.
He's like raising his hands up and it's a very kind of almost Lion King.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Lion King kind of color coming up. And we just get shots of the orchestra from different angles. Different lights are hit on different notes. And I thought it was really interesting because it gives you, it like slowly brings you into what the film is as if Walt knew. People aren't going to know how to react to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if we just go from one and hard cut to animation, they might be like,
that
okay, wait.
Jarring.
Yeah, they might be like, wait, okay, so this is an animation film.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you get the introduction, you get the light and the color, and then you get your animation. So it's more of like a slow flow into it. And again, 7 minutes into the film is when you see your first animation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how did everyone feel about the animation in that first one? It's very, I wrote down ethereal, the floating violin bows and everything like that. I thought it was really beautiful and maybe not something that would be like a fan favorite. I wonder, like, I don't ever remember hearing anyone saying, I love the first sequence is my favorite, but it really sets the tone.
It does. And to me, it was like Melissa kind of said before, it was kind of, just, it's very artsy, like that scene, you know, just the way it flows and the colors, everything. It's a beautiful opening.
Yeah. It leaves a lot open to interpretation. I mean, you wonder, like, what were they thinking when they came up with this particular part of animation? What were they trying to elicit?
Yeah.
Other ones, you know, in the segments, they're pretty like, oh, that's what they wanted because I can literally see the character doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, you can see it as scary in some parts. You can see it as sweet. And I thought, it also reminded me very much, and I think this is 100% on purpose, in Fantasia 2000, the first sequence is those kind of abstract butterflies.
Mm.
And the light pours out from the clouds and everything. And then we have an exact shot like this near the end of the sequence. So, I mean, Scott, how did this sequence first hit you? Now, this is interesting because this is like your first time sitting down watching it.
Yeah.
How did this come at you?
My favorite part of that sequence is actually what we were talking about with the silhouettes of the actual orchestra, because it was almost like they were fighting, you know what I mean, with the music, because they had the one side was shown on the right, and then they, you know, changed the tone of the music, and then they were on the left. It was like a competition almost.
Okay.
Which was kind of cool.
Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's because I took a lot of art classes, but yeah, this to me like really was abstract art, you know, the images, even though you took them as violin bows, like it was could have just been like little like rectangles that, you know, just happened to move and look kind of like that. And yeah. I liked the way that they, with the softer music and the softer tones, it was that ethereal look and pastel colors. And then when you got a little bit more harsher, you got a little bit more bolder lines, and then you had like the red water, but then the gold tones to it. So it was a really nice play between not only just sound, but the picture and the art and how, you know, each line and color could be interpreted a different way depending on the sound of the music. Because I bet you if you muted the music, it wouldn't necessarily, I don't know how much it would like.
Do you think it would take away from it completely? I don't think so.
Sorry. No, I was going to say, like, I don't know if you would necessarily know which part was, like, oh, this is really more dramatic music and this is softer music. Like, you could get in some parts, but I feel like there's other parts where they blend it so well that I don't know if taking the music away, you would know exactly what was going on.
I get what you're saying. The music informs the sequence very much to the point that without the music, maybe you would be a little aimless. You wouldn't know. Scott, going towards what you were saying, it's something that came up later when we meet the orchestra.
Mm. Yeah.
No, meet the sound. Soundtrack. The soundtrack.
The soundtrack, yeah.
How you were saying it with the combinations and this and that and then fighting, it reminded me, for a more modern example for people maybe cling on to, when Remy is trying to teach Emile how to eat food in a way that combines the this and the that, you know, and then you kind of get a glimpse into Emile's mind. The colors are mixing and mashing, and it's put to music. It's put to like jazz music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I kind of also had a little bit of a nod on this. So that's how we start Fantasia, a very dramatic opening start. One of the most dramatic pieces of music to really start anything. And from there, we go into something that I really found interesting. We're going to go into the Nutcracker Suite, which is a Tchaikovsky. Am I saying that correctly?
Sounds like it.
I think that's how I say it. I always feel like I'm missing a vowel or something on that. But I found it very interesting that in the intro to this sequence, Taylor, you know, notes out how no one performs his music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But now you know this music.
Yeah.
Even if you've never seen the Nutcracker on Broadway, or, you know, when it was on Radio City, right?
Yeah, but if you've ever seen a commercial, you know this.
Yeah, like
this
you
music.
Know the Nutcracker Suite now.
Mm-hmm. Well, was he saying that they don't perform it because like the suite is like all the music from the ballet pushed into one like song kind of thing?
No, I think he was saying that it's just not performed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's just not performed. So it's an interesting thing to be like, oh. Well, I know this. Yeah. You know, this is very popular.
And the other thing is, too, he said that this was the work he didn't like this work.
Yeah, he absolutely did. Yeah, he thought this was his worst
thing. He thought this was his worst thing, and it's his most well-known thing.
Funny, because you see that a lot. I mean, to give you a really weird example to tie into, Guns N' Roses.
Mm-hmm.
The song Sweet Child of Mine to them is a joke because it's a notes practice. It's like a bar practice that Slash was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, can you make a riff out of that? He's like, a child can make a riff out of this. And they're like, I bet you we can make it a hit. And like, that's like a huge song for them.
Yeah.
But it was done on a joke.
Yeah.
You know, but everyone thinks that like, that's one of the great songs. And meanwhile, they're like, this song is garbage. You know, so it's interesting how that will happen. So, you know, the person who creates it can't tell how much the audience is going to embrace or, you know, deflect on everything. So we get a series, I think, of very, very popular images in this one. I know that, a segment coming up later is the most popular one. But I want to say this might be close behind it.
There's definitely portions, yeah.
Yeah, there's portions because there are so many different flavors in here that you can get like five, you know, lithographs of different sequences from this sequence.
Right.
Yeah.
So does anyone want to break down? Melissa, do you have it broken down, the little movements that we see in here?
Yeah, I mean, you start off where it's kind of like a springtime, right?
Yeah, it's the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy.
Yeah, and they're, like, sprinkling dew on other flowers, on leaves on the spider web, which
the
I think
is... The spider web really sticks out to me. Yeah,
and
really
it's always to the music, and I love that because it's like perfectly timed.
I'll admit, I have no idea how they do that.
Yeah.
to this day, I don't understand how people do that.
Yeah.
I really don't.
I'll have to sit you down with Brittany Anna.
Yeah, I'm sure your sister, yeah. By the way, for anyone's listening, well, obviously, if you're hearing this, you're listening. Melissa's sister is an animator. She actually also did the cover art for our podcast, as a matter of fact. So, huge thanks. I'm sorry, go ahead. So, yes, we have the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy is the first part.
Yeah.
And then we go into the Chinese dance. This is what it's called.
Yeah, because it's the mushrooms that have a very, very particular look.
Yeah.
With the little hats. Yeah, that look very Asian. And they even have like little slashes for their eyes.
Yeah. Actually, I thought this was interesting because this is the first comedy of the film so far.
Yeah.
And it draws your attention to one specific character. Like, there is a specific character, the smaller mushroom.
Yeah.
In the previous, obviously, it was abstract in the beginning. And the Sugar Plum Fairy, they all somewhat look alike. No one particular stands out. This is your first, I would say, like, hell back to, like, a look, the Silly Symphony way, where there is a lot going on. There's multiple characters, but you're supposed to kind of focus on one.
Yeah, he's like the little odd man out. And I like that they can give like these inanimate objects like such a personality. I thought that was great. And of course, there's like no dialogue and not even real facial expressions, but just in the way that they animate the little movements. It's like, and to go along with the music, it really fits the little character. It's cute.
Yeah, it's cute. And you bring up an interesting point, you know, not real changes in the facial structure, but you still get ideas of emotions. And to give you a very popular example of that, Darth Vader.
No.
He literally never changes his face. But you get what he's thinking when he's, you know, angry or just frustrated or actually trying to communicate with Luke. Like, there's nothing different.
Yeah.
But you look at it differently, and that's done through editing. There's a classic editing thing where a man is eating soup. And if you cut to certain scenes in between him eating soup, it looks like he loves the soup. But if you change it, he looks like he's freezing and the soup is keeping him warm, but it's the same exact footage.
Wow.
So that's a really great like storytelling thing that you picked up right there.
Yeah, I really like that. Kind of going in between scenes, they do a lot of like flowers either falling or water, and there's a lot of like that type of transition.
Mm-hmm.
And in between the mushrooms and the...
Arabian dance.
Yeah, I call it the Russian dance, but...
Okay. Well, no, the Arabian dance is before it with the goldfish.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes, that's the one right before that, and it's so ominous. I don't know why. It feels like they're looking at you like you're the invader.
Oh, yeah.
But they never reveal who they're looking at. See, I always watch that sequence and wait to have like the reveal of what the fish are scared of.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's literally you. Like, you're not supposed to be down there, and then you get... that, you know, Arabian dance.
Yeah, which actually I noted, when you kind of go into the water, the bubble transition was very Cinderella-esque. You know, all the bubbles.
The animation of the bubbles?
Yeah, they reminded me of the Cinderella when she's washing the floor, those bubbles. But that sequence with the fish is one of my favorites. I always remember those type of fish from when I was little, and like I always wanted those type of fish because I just thought they were so beautiful. The animation was so gorgeous. I didn't even know if they were actual fish in real life. Don't know.
Everything that I've read that refers to them as goldfish, but I don't know. Is there a type of goldfish with a translucent tail? Scott, you got any fish theories over there?
No, I'm not really a fish man.
Unless he's eating it.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I want to go to somewhere good, not Red Lobster.
Yeah.
Red Lobster, if nothing else is available. So,
but yeah, I love that sequence with the fish.
Okay, very cool. And I then, like that. Does anyone else have anything to throw onto that?
No, I mean, it's... This is a really long sequence.
Oh, yeah.
This is not like later. Long. No, not like later. But it's really long, and I just like the way they transition between the seasons, and that they constantly throughout the whole thing they changed up, you know, what they're animating, and it all fits perfectly with the music. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, it goes from summer to autumn to winter.
Yeah,
that's the one I remember the most. The winter one.
Yeah,
it's when I was a kid. They used to have. Around the holidays is to have those shorts that came out, and that was one that I always watched, and I always remember it was just so beautiful, you know, that they were figure skating, and yeah, then all the you know, the ice was cracking all over. It was
that's my favorite one. But right before that, we get the Russian dance with the thistles and the orchids as women, and I put in here, this so far, this is the most high energy piece that we've gotten so far.
Yeah.
Even though the very first segment has a very dramatic music to it, I felt this was the most like, you know, wake up. You know, this was kind of like that first sequence that really kind of hit you. And then, yeah, then we transfer, we segue basically into the winter sequence.
Which I love how they do it, because it's like they take the flowers, the thistles and the orchids, and they do kind of like a freeze frame, and it almost turns into like, I hate to say it this way, but it almost looks like so real. It's like transitioned from animation to almost like an oil painting.
Okay.
And then you move through the flowers into, excuse me, into the area where now the winter fairies are, you know, waking up and frosting everything.
Well, we're gonna get to a sequence later on, the very end of the film, that is, does that same kind of camera movement, much longer, much more intense.
Yes.
But we'll, you know, we'll bring that up later, of course. Do we think, actually, Scott, going exactly to what you said, I know that the iconic image of this film might be kind of obvious, but as a nominee, the ice fairies dancing, skating on the ice side by side. Yeah. I think that should be one of our iconic nominees. And actually, you know what? I'm sorry. For anyone who is new to the show and has never listened to it before, at the end of this, we're going to ask three questions of this film. Number one, what is the iconic shot of the film? Number two, does the film hold up? And number three, in no particular order, what is the quote-unquote heart of the film? Is it a moral lesson, or is it simply trying to elicit an emotion out of you, or is it trying to do both? Which, you'd be surprised how many films are usually just one or the other. It's the rarer ones that are both. We've sort of finding so far.
Yeah.
So, would that be okay? Can we nominate that? Because I feel like I've seen that in a million lithographs.
Yeah.
Oh, you definitely.
Know, the two winter fairies, one, you know, parallel with each other, skating on the ice.
Yeah.
So that would be one. But as we go into the introduction of our next sequence, we get, I think without a doubt, one of the most popular animated sequences ever. This is, of course, The Sorcerer's Apprentice with Mickey Mouse, based on a poem written by Goethe, which was written in 1797. I did not know that. It's actually a ballad of 14 stanzas.
Oh, wow.
And the music was written in 1896 to 1897, somewhere in that area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was originally
written for this also, but then I read somewhere else. It's got to be wrong, right?
No, because they said on the in the movie, they say that this one was... The music was actually written for this piece. The animation was done before. Like they had the story already for this, and they wrote the music around the story, as opposed to the other way around, kind of where they had the music and then they kind of fit the animation around the music.
Yeah. Okay. Because I had read that out of the sequences, seven of them were classics, and then one was an original.
Was an original piece, yeah. That's what I had read. I mean, that's what they said in the...
Because they mentioned the composer, the Paul Dukas was the...
Yeah, but Paul Dukas also lived in the 1800s.
Oh, so maybe that's the thing.
You know what, though? Yeah, I mean, Paul Dukas, well, he died in 1935. Let me read you the... this is actually from Wiki. I just did a quick search because there's got to be some kind of weird thing. It says The Sorcerer's Apprentice is a symphonic poem by French composer Paul Dukas, written in 1896 to 1897. Now, if I look on what symphonic poem is, it's a tone poem. It says, a piece of orchestral or concert band music, usually in a single continuous section, that illustrates or evokes the content of a poem.
So it was like original rap.
Yeah, why not? Okay, yeah, that'll work. So maybe I don't know. I mean, I could honestly, this information could be wrong as well, because I was always under the idea that the music was written specifically for the sequence.
Well, and I think you were under that impression because that's what they said in the movie.
Yeah.
Like the narrator says it. That's what he says.
Yeah.
The only thing I could think of is maybe like he had the symphonic poem and then they added more to it to make it specific for this?
I guess. I mean, it was also called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I mean, that's what the poem is about. The poem is literally about the story that you see.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
just plug in Mickey Mouse.
I don't know that.
So...
Oh, very interesting. We'll have to look at that more.
It's an interesting thing. Guys, if you have other information on this, because this was something that I thought was, yeah, they wrote it for this. That was always what I had heard. That is always what I had been told.
Yeah.
And, but then looking into it, the man died in 1935. The man who wrote the music died in 35.
Mm.
So that's way before they started doing this movie.
Unless Walt was like talking to him.
He wrote
like...
it on his deathbed.
Wasn't the Sorcerer's Apprentice, I believe, weren't they working on that before? Wasn't that what brought them? Because that was supposed to be a silly symphony that was too big, so then they decided to...
Yeah.
That's what I had read also. They decided to make it into
So he could have, film. Worked
so
on
maybe,
it
maybe
before.
He could have worked on it right before.
Well, I don't know. According to, you know, information, he wrote it back in 1866 to 1867, somewhere in that area.
That's pretty crazy.
So
we'll have to deep dive on that.
Yeah, we're going to have to... I'm sorry, 1896 to 1897. I apologize. He would have had to have been a Time Lord.
Yeah, that
would... have done that.
That would be cool.
And yeah, then this was... that ballad was based on a piece that was written by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the 1797 poem of the same name.
Wow, okay.
So it's an interesting little line that we get to what winds up being a reintroduction of Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a different design into this. It was a more cute, a little more trying to, you know, like, it's just a different look for him. Even though, you know, he had always been kind of mischievous, this is his last kind of mischievous thing. Mm-hmm. They, you know, he doesn't really go too far into that again, like past these moments, all that much. And now he's a very different character, in my opinion, nowadays. Yeah. I prefer this. I prefer the mischievous mouse. I like that.
Yeah, I like that too.
So that's really what this is all based on. This was directed by James Alger as well. And, I mean, what is there to be said about this? This is your introduction to Yen Sid,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, our magician. And, of course, that's Disney spelt backwards. And obviously, our iconic nominee is all over this sequence.
Yeah.
But what is the iconic shot? We'll get to that later. But I mean, did anyone not know this front to back before you watched it on this viewing?
I knew it, but the one part of the sequence I didn't remember that was the way it was when he wakes up and the broom is flooded the room.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he takes the giant axe and he goes and
kills
chops
it.
Him up. Yeah, yeah, I thought that he would, like, I thought he just closed the door so it couldn't get in anymore. And then it, like, I don't know, replicated itself. But I don't remember, like, actually seeing the shadow of him cutting up the broom.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, wow.
Pretty violent.
I think he got pretty violent right there.
Yeah.
Man, like,
and
just water, man.
Come what's on. Really interesting is if you look very closely, after that happens, when he chops up the broom.
You're going to take it. I know exactly what you're going to say.
you want to go ahead, do it.
Okay, no, I was going to say, yeah, after he chops it up and you see his shadow and it's like a red background and the shadow and it's very dramatic, then there's no color. It's black and white.
It's black and white.
And it doesn't start to come into color until the broom starts to come back to life.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting. I did not remember that part.
For years, when I had the DVD, because that was how I first... I mean, I'm sure I watched it on VHS at some point when I was a kid. But when I first got it on DVD, I was like, oh, they screwed up. Like, what the hell just happened? The color just went.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But because at that time when I watched it, I wasn't able to make that connection of, oh, no, he killed the magic.
Mm-hmm.
And now as the magic comes back, so there does the color.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really, really great.
Yeah.
I remember somebody once, I don't know if it was a conversation or whatnot, they were trying to tell other people that Yen Sid was like an evil sorcerer. Because he makes the skull. And it's like, no, he does that, but it turns out to be a butterfly.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's supposed to symbolize, you know, how that kind of thing can be beautiful and dangerous all at once. You know, if in the wrong hands of somebody, you know, yada, 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 you can go that way. So, I mean, this is a classic one. I don't really know if we can shed so much light into it except going over play-by-play all of our favorite moments.
No.
I mean, do you have a favorite moment of this sequence, actually? I do.
Well, I was just also going to talk about how, like, the water in it was very similar to the water in Pinocchio, when we know that they had gone into a lot of, you know, I guess, research in how water moves and works and everything like that for Pinocchio. And then this film, but the sequence also in particular, has a lot of that water with the splashing and the waves. And I guess that's probably part of my favorite portion of this, is when he's on the rock and he's swirling the stars and the comets. I think that's like one of my favorite parts.
Tell me this thing wouldn't look spectacular in 3D.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It'd be amazing.
So many parts of it, too, this, not just the
sequence. I think this entire program.
Yeah, definitely.
If you want to repackage Fantasia and put it into a theater right now and get people interested, you put this as a 3D film, and I think it would be a smash, because this is filmed in a 3D sense.
Yeah.
You know, there are layers in every shot. Nothing is flat. So I think it could be absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, my favorite shot is him up on the mountaintop. That would be... Here were the two things that I thought of. Well, there's really three. There's three shots that I think we could nominate for iconic image.
Yeah.
Number one, Mickey bringing the broom initially to life.
Yes.
Number two, Mickey up on the mountaintop.
Doing what, though?
Well, the one particular, when his hand's up in the air.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when his finger's up in the air. And then the third would actually be at the closing, when he is shaking hands with Leopold Stokowski.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a fourth.
Oh, go ahead.
The scene where he's like bouncing and the dancing with the broom and the broom's behind. That's an iconic shot also.
That is as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot. I mean, this is just classic. This is an instant classic. This sequence. It's something that will forever be in the parks. Thank God.
Oh, thank you.
I actually really, really hope. Maybe I'll get to talk about this one day on another show. I really hope that if they ever redesign the Great Movie Ride, Fantasia doesn't just get a windsock.
It gets
a full scene of the Sorcerer's Apprentice with the animatronics that they have currently. Mm-hmm. And you go through that sequence with all the brooms around you.
That would be awesome.
That would be great.
And Mickey, you know, dancing, or maybe then Mickey's on the mountain.
They could even make a dark ride.
Yeah.
There's enough in that for it to be a dark ride.
I don't think they ever will.
No, I don't think so either, but definitely.
Absolutely.
My iconic scene in that is a little weird, but is when the sorcerer actually is going up the stairs and you see Mickey's shadow.
Oh, I know what you're
And he's
about.
Looking at from the bottom of the stairs, you know?
Okay.
Like, it's cool because, I don't know, going into it, I'm sure people were kind of like, you know, well, where's Mickey? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh,
he had a hero's entrance. Yeah. He had a cool, actually, what is this? This is 1940. You know what? Someone else, a previous film, I can't think of the year it was made, uses shadows to introduce a very big star into their film. And, you know, it was like a big moment. And at first you see his shadow up on the wall. It was 1949, The Third Man. And it was the introduction of Orson Welles.
Oh, wow.
Where you see him only from the shadow on the ground, and then you kind of follow him, and then the light illuminates his face.
Yeah.
So, not the same, but it just made me think of it the way you described it. So, let's move past Sorcerer's Apprentice, because we could be there all night speaking about that film. Oh, I'm sorry. I really love the scene where he gives the hat back.
And he looks abashed.
Yeah, he looks very abashed. And Yed Sid hits him with the broom.
Yes.
I really love that look, though. When he turns and smiles, that is the Mickey Mouse that I think of.
Yeah.
That animation on him at that specific moment is really, really phenomenal. So moving on now, we go into the longest sequence of the film by far. I believe it's 25 minutes long.
Time and feel.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like that. This is where, for me, this film hits a screeching halt. But I have some ideas towards why. Now, it's The Rite of Spring. It's based on the music by Igor Stravinsky. It was directed by Bill Roberts and Paul Satterford. And this is basically the dinosaur one. Like, you know, if I want to put the easiest term possible, it's the dinosaur one. And
but it starts.
Yes.
It starts way back.
It starts, you know, we basically see the Earth being born. We see cellular mitosis. I mean, am I wrong?
It like starts from like first the universe and galaxies and all that forming. And then you get to Earth where it's like very hot and you have all the lava and everything. Mm-hmm. Then you get to the water and then it's a single cell to then. I really like the smoke effect, though, that they do, because it's. In this sequence in particular, they use a lot of real what's the word? It's not animation. It's real effects.
Okay.
You know, like...
practical.
There we go. So the smoke that transitions between the single cell to the multi-cell to the fish, it's a real practical smoke effect.
Okay.
And
then I know this is one of your favorite little things on it, the volcanoes.
Yeah, in the beginning when the earth is like forming and the lava is going everywhere, the volcanoes, you can see in the background, there's continuous smoke coming up from them. And that's a practical effect that they did where they filmed paint going into water.
Yep.
And it had that, you know, pluming kind of effect. And then they flipped it.
Flip the frame and
then you got volcanoes.
Or filmed it upside down. I'm not sure.
No, they flipped it because you poured the paint into like a tank of water, like a fish tank.
Yes.
So that image of the paint going down would then have to get flipped for the smoke to go up.
I was saying if the camera was upside down.
Oh.
I didn't know if the camera was upside down or they actually flipped the negative.
Could they do that?
I don't know, because if you install a battery in the computer upside down, evidently it doesn't turn off. So I'm not sure.
They flipped it somehow. Yeah,
they flipped it somehow. It was one aspect or the other.
That was on the documentary.
So this is, you know, a condensed version of the history of Earth, basically, the formation of Earth.
Yep.
And then we see dinosaurs and then the death of dinosaurs. And, I mean, it doesn't end on a good note.
No.
You know, it's basically that end, and then we get a sunrise, an eclipse. Is that what we get?
Yeah, eclipse. It's a solar eclipse.
Yeah, we get a solar eclipse, and that's how we end. So it's like the end, the dying of one world that will eventually give birth to man,
yeah.
You know, to him inheriting the earth. My big question on this is this sequence, because we'll just talk about this particular sequence and its effect on modern. In a world where Jurassic Park exists, does anyone care about watching this for 25 minutes?
I don't think so. I think it also goes on very long because you get the very dramatic, you know, fight between the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the other dinosaurs.
Stegosaurus.
That one? Okay.
Yeah.
And then it goes on after that to the whole migration of the dinosaurs through the desert, getting struck in the tar pits, starving, blah, 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 earthquakes. It goes on well
imagery.
After that.
Pretty
yeah.
harsh imagery.
Yeah.
Them, like, starving with their mouths gape, like, you know, stepping through all the sludge. It was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, and you could see, like, some bones in them. Like, they were starving. They were literally dying.
Somebody throw a pie, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like that just took way too long. And I know it always loses me when I watch the movie. I'll usually just skip over the sequence, honestly. But I feel like in modern times, it would also lose audiences.
I felt very disturbed by that fight scene. Like, I know it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but there's like 30 dinosaurs watching the Stegosaurus fight this thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, come on, really?
Dude, that's modern day. Look, it's going YouTube.
That's true.
Yeah.
Everyone just, they all record it and they don't do anything to stop it.
That's true.
You know, so they were calling it out like way before they even had it. Brian, how's your thoughts on this?
It's too long. I like the very beginning when the earth is forming and stuff. I really like that sequence. But then once they get to the dinosaurs, it's just too much, too long. And like you said, I don't think it would play very well, especially after what we've seen now. At that time, maybe it played better.
I think that's exactly what it is. It's just a matter of this sequence in the modern day. It isn't timeless.
Yeah, this is the one sequence that I think did not age well.
Mm.
You know, it's doesn't. Every other sequence, for the most part, every other sequence, I think, would be fine now. But this one,
I agree. Doesn't, because the mystery and allure of what they're talking about, we've seen in other mediums, in the same medium,
mm-hmm.
and done at a much more entertaining pace.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't think it works as well.
It was cool though to see that the way the animators, because we know so much more now
mm-hmm.
about the way dinosaurs lived and the way they.
That's true.
You know, so it was cool to see their interpretation of what they think that they. You know, how they fed, how they, you know, migrated and all that stuff.
Yeah, if you look back on it, like, and try and put yourself, then it was probably pretty
mm-hmm.
amazing.
Yeah.
Because until that point, have there ever really been anything like that, type of scene on film before? I would think not, right?
I don't think so.
You know, because that's not something they could live action film, you know?
No, because later in life you would have,
Land of the Lost?
Claymation.
The Clash of the Titans?
Clash of the
Titans. Yeah, but I'm trying to think of the man's name.
Oh, that's all you.
Oh, my God.
Harry Harryhausen.
Yes.
That's his name.
Sinbad and...
I have his autograph.
Yes.
Yes. I have his autograph on a half sheet of Clash of the Titans. One of my favorite things that I have. So, I don't think it just doesn't hold up as well. No. It's not overly interesting. So... After that, we go into the Meet the Soundtrack. Will we go into an intermission? Do you have something you wanted to add?
Oh, no. I was just going to say, we also had talked about this, like, with the music in this part also. The other music in the film overall has a very, not necessarily upbeat, but it's very peppy in the notes, and they're very, you know, brisk. And this one is very long and drawn-out notes that blend together, and it is. It's like CB type
music.
It
makes me sleepy.
Yeah.
It made me sleepy. It always does. This one always, like, puts me to sleep. I don't know why. So now we're going to go, and we're going to meet the soundtrack after our intermission, which I always love. The last movie I remember seeing in the theater with an intermission was Braveheart. I think that was the last one that I had. So to see a film, you know, with an intermission always kind of reminds me of, oh, yeah, they don't do that anymore. So I like this sequence. This is a cute little sequence. It was a nice in-betweener. I mean, this almost comes at the exact middle of the film. It's about an hour and 5 minutes in, and this is a 2-hour and 5-minute film. So also a very long film for Disney animation standards, especially considering the next movie that comes up, which is almost half that length. So... I thought this was fun. And again, it made me think of Ratatouille with the combination of colors and sound as, you know, we basically had a soundtrack line and it would just, you know, animate to the different, you know, instruments that they would introduce and whatnot. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, I really liked that part, actually.
Yeah, I had a good time with this one.
Yeah, I said it reminded me of like an equalizer that you would see like now on a screensaver or something that would go to the music, you know.
But yeah,
it was just very simple, one line, and I don't know. I thought they did a really great job of interpreting how the line should react based on the instruments, whether it was curved or sharp.
There's a really fun little piece. I forget. Is it the oboe that goes really, really low?
I believe so.
And if you look at maybe it's the bassoon. I'm not sure.
Whatever
instrument it was, it went very, very low. If you look at the edges of the animation, it looks like tongues like flapping. So I always thought that was kind of cool. So from that, we move on to I think a phenomenal sequence. And when you look at who was behind it, you kind of figure out why. This is the Pastoral Symphony. And it's based off of Beethoven, the Symphony Number 6 in F, the Pastoral. This was directed by three men, Ford Beebe, Jim Hanley, and Hamilton Lusk. But the really interesting thing I find to this is the animation supervisors, Fred Moore, Ward Kimball, Eric Larson, Art Babbitt, Ollie Johnson, and Don Talley. It's like an all-star resort that they were all kind of working on this one together. So... that stuck out to me immensely, the fact that these guys all work together on this particular piece. And I think it's really great. The story in a quick serving is... How do we start off with this, Melissa? With the centaurs?
No, with the unicorns. And the pans, the fauns playing the not flutes, flute. But...
Just call it flute. It's okay.
Yeah, they were playing the little instruments and with the unicorns, and then you transition into the Pegasus, the family, with the mother and the babies, and teaching the little black Pegasus how to fly kind of thing.
And again, here, we get that, like we did with the mushroom and with Mickey, we get the black Pegasus, which is kind of your focal point. Mm-hmm. But they use that technique of storytelling in this particular sequence multiple times over.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you sort of focus in on somebody, even if it's Bacchus and his donkey, you know, later on. Like, you are sort of like, okay, I want to look at this in particular. You know what I was thinking of when we were watching this? During the courting scene, where you have the fauns, you know, playing the... Or no, maybe it was... I take that back. It was previous to that.
Okay.
The pawns has the same face as Lampwick from Pinocchio.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah. I kept thinking, I was like, oh my God, it's the same exact scene. The same face. I just kept seeing it over and over and over again in my head. So, I mean, Brian, how did you... I'm sorry, Melissa, continue. What were we going through?
Oh, yeah. After the Pegasus, you know, you have... First the family of them, and then they, you know, fly through the sky, and then they land in water, and then a whole bunch more Pegasus come, and then you transition from the, you know, all the Pegasus into the centaurs, and you have the female centaurs and the male.
Courting scene. I mean, it's a courting scene.
Well, it's like the Cupids. The little Cupids are getting the females who are, like, on one side to go with the males on the other. Yeah, and then you have, like, the little, you know,
like a middle school dance.
I guess, yeah.
All right, I guess. I don't think they dance, though.
Well,
some of them do.
They walk.
I don't know why, but this had a very, like, sexual tone.
It did.
I felt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I absolutely thought that.
Yeah.
The women centaurs are very sensually drawn.
Yeah, they are.
And there is, like, that as close as Disney can get. I mean, there's even the thing ends with one of the cherubs, if we can call him that, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, sticking his head between the curtains to almost peek on the two centaurs that are in a... What's the word I'm looking for?
Like a gazebo.
A gazebo, yeah. I don't know. I thought... I mean, there is nudity in this film. It's not like they shied away from it. It's just funny because that would never happen now. I thought that was, you know, it's weird how we've gotten so uptight towards certain things, even when it's in a cartoon form. So after we have our whole, you know, centaur courting sequence, we get introduced to Bacchus.
Yep, god of wine.
The god of wine and his little horned donkey.
Who has a name. Yeah,
it's he has a name?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what his name is.
I have it.
Oh, find out what his name is, please. And, after all their shenanigans, we get a Zeus who, outside of the hair, is the Zeus from Hercules.
That's the point I was going to make. Watching this, it reminded me of Hercules a lot.
I looked up, like, the animation for Zeus in Hercules, and I was like, outside of the hair,
that
it's the same face.
But just even, like, the color, like, the colors, that, like, pastel-y color, it looked like Hercules. The god sequences in Hercules.
When I was watching the opening scenes with all the Pegasus and stuff like that, besides the black Pegasus, I was like, those look like the one from Hercules when he was a baby.
Yeah. When they made him.
They all look the same, but they look just like him.
In Hercules, they make the thing, make a cloud blanket, basically, and then you actually see Zeus pull a cloud over him.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed that whole sequence a lot, but man, Zeus is a bit of a schmuck, huh?
He wanted to break up the party.
That was my favorite part.
Yeah.
Throwing everything at everybody?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it reminded me of, if you've ever read the book or seen the film The Time Machine, it's the Morlocks and the Eloi. And the Eloi are, like, blissfully ignorant about everything. Mm-hmm. They just go along and get the food that's fed to them. They never work. And during the centaur sequence, I was like, they're the Eloi.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know, but it's in reverse because, you know, they would be living above, you know, the Morlocks. So I thought that was really interesting. But, yeah, Zeus just tries to kill everyone, basically.
Yeah, the part where the guy's holding the lightning bolt, and Zeus is like, no, we're good.
Yeah.
And then the guy's like, and he throws it anyway.
Yeah. I thought that was really, really funny. And, you know, there's something interesting about this sequence as well, is that daylight is, how do I put this? Let me reinterpret this. When the film goes to night, this short, that's when everything becomes peaceful and calm.
Right.
And two sequences later, it's nighttime that brings upon evil, and it's daylight that breaks it.
Mm-hmm.
Where in this, like, the debauchery stops because it's time to go to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, during the day, it's a madhouse, and then it turns calm into night, where in Bald Mountain, which we're going to talk about soon, it is the reverse of that. You know, the night is the night of horror, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's the dawn that breaks that evil.
Well, I guess you could interpret it because, like, in this sequence, it's like the, not real world, but, like, the upper world is, you know, during the day, and then the other world of Bald Mountain comes out at night. So, like, the other world is...
Because I don't know what town that is in Bald Mountain, but you shouldn't live there.
Looks like Halloween Town.
I wouldn't even visit.
Doesn't look good.
Wouldn't even visit.
Doesn't look good. I want a Hellboy comic that takes place in that town.
Yeah.
Maybe it would fit beautifully. So, what are your guys' thoughts on this segment? Does it still, you know, just separately, does this one still work for you, Brian?
Yeah, definitely. I think it does.
Melissa?
Yeah, I love this sequence.
This is one of your favorite ones, right?
It is. I love, you know, the whole, like, male and female centaurs pairing up, the coloring, all that different type of stuff. And I love at the end with all like the Greek mythology that, you know, with the goddess, you know, of the rainbow, Iris and Morpheus and Diana with the stars, like just all
that
of those.
That shot is gorgeous.
Yeah, her she shooting uses the bow. The crescent
oh,
moon.
Oh, yeah, that's really
God,
nice.
God, I love that shot. Yeah. That would be a poster I'd put on the wall. Make a nice piece of art from that, and I would
and I'm trying to remember because now I have Hercules in my head. In this, is there a scene with the guy flying across, making it turn into night?
Yeah, the one pulling the chariot, Apollo pulls the sun,
Apollo,
and then
that's right.
Morpheus brings the night. He's like the actual knight that comes.
Yeah, but there's that scene similar to that in Hercules, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, with the chariot goes across, and that's how it changes from. It changes from day to night. He brings night over.
Yeah, it's in like the beginning.
It's sequence. In the beginning. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Almost. All right. Yep. Very cool. Yeah, a lot of, you know, once you start looking back in Disney history, you see a lot of things in front. Oh, Brian, I had to bring this to you. One final thing, Bacchus. There's two things I thought of.
His donkey's name is Jackus. Just to let you know.
Oh, nice, Bacchus and Jackus.
Yeah,
that's good stuff. Bacchus, hedonism bot. Thought of him immediately from Futurama.
Yeah.
And then number two, or really number one, Dom DeLuise from History of the World.
Oh, my God,
this
yes.
Is exactly. Like, I saw him, and I'm like, oh, God, it's so perfect.
It is.
Dom DeLuise.
The donkey kind of reminded me of the Pinocchio donkeys.
Yes, they look like the same animation, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looked like they lifted the faces and threw a horn on them. So we got Lampwick's face, and we got him as a donkey. You know what? Maybe we can say this is where Lampwick winds up.
There you go.
All right, he's not a slave in the salt mines. Snow White's dead.
It's all connected.
Lampwick is in the
thing. No, Snow White went to heaven.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Well, that's death. Yes.
Yeah, but still.
Oh, okay. Yes.
See, this is a shared universe. It started with Marvel. No, started right here.
Started right here. Let's go into our next sequence. A segment that I barely remembered.
Oh, really?
I did. I really did. I barely remember.
Well, like I said, I didn't remember until I saw it that I was like, oh. How I remember it was, that's the scene from Twice Upon a Christmas. Yep. Like, those are the same characters in Twice Upon a Christmas. That's how I remembered the scene.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is The Dance of Hours. The musical score I'm going to completely butcher, so stand by. Amakara Pancielli. And it's La Gioconda, Dance of the Hours. This was directed by Norm Ferguson, and I just have T. He. Is that real?
Tee-hee.
I don't have his first name. It just says T.He. So T.He. So apologies to whoever did that. Sorry about that. I think this is the most hysterical sequence in the film by far.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's
I thought this was absolutely fantastic. This is a silly symphony in its own. I know they're all silly symphonies in their own, but this one could have been a 3-minute cartoon.
Yeah, because
definitely.
You
know, like this is where it is.
Stuff.
And I know me and you were thinking, when we heard the music, we thought of the Camp Granada song.
Yeah.
Da-na-na-na,
da-na-na-na.
So I forgot this was the music for this.
Yeah.
I didn't remember. I mean, Scott.
I did.
How familiar were you with the sequence, Scott?
I had the same as Brian. I remembered it because I remember when I saw it in Twice Upon a Christmas, I'm like, oh, that was from Fantasia. They know the same characters, the hippos and
hippos.
The tutus and there's the alligators. And,
yeah.
But I wasn't familiar with the actual sequence in Fantasia.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I mean, Melissa, was this one that you were over? I mean, you said just before you do remember this one pretty well.
Yeah.
Did you know the alligator has a name?
I did not know that.
Ben Alligator.
Really?
Yep.
That's funny. Yeah. I didn't know they were alligators, not crocodiles.
Oh,
nice.
Okay. That's something.
That's good.
Did someone say they were crocodiles?
Brian.
Oh, but then you? I just said they were alligators now.
No, yeah. Okay. When you were first talking about it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. How dare you?
I forgot what their snouts looked like.
So, something I pointed out, the facial animation on the hippos is phenomenal. It's my favorite part of the thing, and it made me think of Rabbit of Seville with Bugs Bunny when he is... putting the lotion on like Elmer Fudd's face and he's just deadpan staring into the camera. It's not the same thing, but it made me think of nailing facial animation to get you to, you know, that kind of bashful, funny look that all the hippos have. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And the main alligator is absolutely hysterical.
Yeah.
When she jumps for the lift and he just like puts his hands up and yeah. immediately just gets crushed.
Yeah.
I just absolutely loved it. This was the most fun that I have watching Fantasia.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the most fun scene.
I'll go back to watch this now, like, on occasion, only by itself if I want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll really, really enjoy it.
I think aside from The Sorcerer's Apprentice, this is also one of the ones with, like, the most characters, you know, in terms of, like, being really funny and joking around and being bashful and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's more, like,
emotion?
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
Like, per character, yeah. Like, they have, and they have, like, the goofy around, you know, kind of, I don't know,
you
demeanor.
Mean, like, fully fleshed out? Like, they have specific personalities?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know how, like, okay. Mickey was, like, a little personality? Like, yeah. I feel like this sequence also, like, each the characters had more personality, whereas, like, you know, like, the centers, like, they had, you know, they were nice, but, like, there was no, like, emotion to them, per se.
No, but, I mean, you do get... Because I'm thinking, like, that would be the only other sequence I would think that maybe has more, like, specific characters, because Bacchus.
Yeah.
The black uniform. Zeus. The black uniform.
Unicorn.
Unicorn.
Pegasus. He has a uniform, too.
Zeus. Well, I think Pegasus is the older one.
Is the baby, like, Pegasus was black, yeah.
Isn't Pegasus, like, their name, though? Or is that their race name?
No, that's their, the name of the...
Like a horse and a Pegasus. It's like...
Oh, okay. I always thought Pegasus was, like, his name.
In Hercules it is, but...
Okay, all right.
Yeah, but he was the first one.
True.
Yeah, so
that's
Pegasus
why
won.
Pegasus was Pegasus.
Okay. Wow, what a stupid conversation.
Black uniforms.
Yeah, just forget we ever talked about that, folks. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting, yeah, to try to figure out which sequence had the most specific characters. Like, I know you because you're different than all the others...
Mm-hmm. I guess, but more just like because it was like, I don't know, I felt like more connected to it. It was
they had more person. They had more personality
yeah, yeah.
to them. Like,
yeah, yeah.
The emotions came through more.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I'm sorry, I took that a different way.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't wording it correctly.
Okay. Well, yeah, I would agree with that, especially the alligator's so great. He's so great.
And I love the evil alligators. Like, they were all, like, you know, with the hoods and stuff.
Yeah, and then he just comes out. He's
with
not,
the hat.
but he is the leader. You know, because he comes out and he basically scares everyone else away from her.
Yeah.
But then he's, like, the silliest character in the entire film.
Yeah.
So this was a lot of fun. I really want a 3D version of this all of a sudden. And I want everyone should watch Rabbit of Seville. So did anyone want to say anything about that further? Or do you want to go into our final segment?
No, let's go into the final segment.
Okay, let's go into the final segment. This is Night on Bald Mountain. It actually, well, there's two pieces of music to this, I should say. It's Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria. Franz Schubert was Ave Maria, and
Mussorgsky,
yes, yeah. Was Night on Bald Mountain. Thank you for the pronunciation. And special little thing, directed by Wilfred Jackson, who, if you look at, you can find them online. He was the model for Chernabog.
Oh, wow.
He did the poses, and they took photos of him. And that's how they then, you know, had, like, the idea thing. A lot of people like to equate Chernabog to Bela Lugosi.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he uses his hands and whatnot. And I don't doubt that that was part of it. But there's actual photographic proof that the director, again, Wilfred Jackson, did that. Like, he was the model that he's then, you know, based off of at least the poses and the movements.
Yeah.
Which I really like, because a great artist, a comic book artist, Alex Ross, he does, you know, airbrushing and painting and whatnot. He takes photos of people doing the poses of, like, Superman and whatnot, and then goes from there. You know, he lights it the way you would light a scene, and then he works from there. So I'll see if I can, I'll try to find a couple of those photos online and throw them onto the website when I post up the show. This to me is the highlight of Fantasia. For me, it is. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a horror film in the beginning.
It is,
and then it brings me to tears at the end, because I think it's absolutely gorgeous. The music is perfection. The effects are really something. I really feel like we should have double checked. The animation, or the effect, I should say, of the bodies raising up out of the graves.
Yeah.
They use that by almost like using a reflection on a mirror of some sort.
Yeah, it was like almost like a curved piece of metal that like they projected these images on and then filmed it. And then, yeah, you can like tell when the bodies are coming out of the graves.
Yeah.
It's not animation. When they're in the sky, it's clearly animation, but they use also like chalk on black black paper.
Yeah.
So they actually also did that very uniquely also.
But if you watch the bodies coming out of the graves, they're not moving. They're just images that are swaying.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really such a creepy, gorgeous effect. The hand animation on Chernabog is incredible. It is so articulated. It you know, it's really what you see most of him.
Yeah. That's what I really noticed watching this again was the hands.
Yeah.
You know, they were. It was fantastic.
It was really, really something.
I think him in general is, especially at that time, it's so not realistic looking, cause, but it's like, I can't think of a word to use it. It's the most realistic, you know, animation that I think they've done up to that point.
Yeah, because compared to like Snow White and
Pinocchio,
mm-hmm. it was the most like, I guess, human looking.
Talking about the human physiology of
right.
the character.
Yeah, it was the most realistic to be in.
You know, you look past the horns and the eyes.
Yeah.
His chest and his arms.
Yeah.
They are human.
Yeah. Even like, you know, his face a couple of times when it's just like his eyes and his mouth.
Uh-huh.
That's in the scene with his hands. It's like, so the highlights on his face are just perfect.
Yeah. This is the cinematography in this animated feature is absolutely out of this world. It just lends to the story immensely. This would also get my other iconic image nominee, which is near the beginning when he raises up out of the mountain and he has his hands above him.
Yeah.
And the mountain is his body, basically.
And they have like the swirl of the undead going around him?
No, they're not even there yet. This is like the very beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the very beginning. It's kind of like where he's starting. Another thing during the sequence that I absolutely loved was when the bell begins to toll and dawn starts to come about,
mm-hmm.
he tries to show strength, like, in the face of dawn, but then still, like, recoils back. After a couple of times, he tries to, like, you know, kind of put his chest out a little bit almost, and nah, I'm not going to, but then he just has to recoil immediately. And I thought was really, really great was when he, you know, relents and goes back into his mountain, watch his hand movements, because he reaches for heaven first, but then falls back into his mountain. But he reaches up almost grasping and then goes back down. So I thought that was really, really interesting. Like, I don't know if they meant it this way, but ultimately this character would still love to ascend, but he just can't. And he just goes right back down into his hole. What were other things? Melissa, what were some things that stuck out for you in this sequence?
Well, in particular, you know, in, I guess, the climax of this scene, when you have Chernabog with his minions kind of in the mountain, I noticed that this was the first time that they used the yellow and green fire to represent evil, which will come back up with Maleficent.
Oh, yeah. Good catch.
You know what? I picked that up also when I saw it. I was like, oh, it's the green fire.
Yeah, because they don't put a lot of orange. I'll do it a couple times in this scene, but particularly, especially when you like first get into it, the first flames that shoot up with him, it's yellow and green.
Mm-hmm. Now, but that's interesting, though, because we've already established that green eyes have been a thing on evil characters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they definitely do use the color green to represent evil in multiple occasions. So this is something, again, this is something that we notice only because we're watching
we're going in that kind of order.
But yeah, the use of the color green to a large extent, I mean, Jiminy Cricket is not green, to a large extent has been evil.
Yeah.
So that's really kind of interesting. Scott, for you, was there any other specifics of this sequence? I have a couple, but I'll just wait till the end.
Yeah, the scene where, again, with his hands, he's got the he picks up the flames, and then it turns into the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
That whole scene, and then it goes into the little minions that are jumping around, and then it goes to like almost like roaches or something like that crawling over his hand,
and they're just trying to keep onto his hands, and then he just casts them into the fire anyway.
Yeah, that was like
so great.
That was a great scene. That was so fantastic. Good. Yeah.
Brian, was there anything else that stuck out specifically for you?
I love the scene when he when he like descends the darkness onto the town, you know, and how it just like kind of
shoots
envelops
his hands down,
and it just like envelops the buildings and stuff. I thought that was great.
Yeah,
I
like
love
his
that
shadow
part.
Reaches out to everything and touches
out
it.
When was Nosferatu made? That would be a very, very Nosferatu sort of idea, because in that film, in the original silent film, which was in 1922, so yeah, I assumed it was before that, but I want to get a number. That's something that they play with a lot in that, is that his shadow is a is an entity of its own.
Yeah.
And they do that in that, you know, 1922, so I wouldn't be surprised if that, you know, bled its way into this. And didn't I bring that up before? Wasn't there something about Nosferatu that I mentioned towards? I want to say it was something. Oh, I know what it was. It was the wood, the forest sequence of Snow White running away.
Yeah, with the trees.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
Very German impressionistic, and it made me think of the use of shadows in Nosferatu. So that's actually twice that it kind of lent towards Nosferatu. Something I really. A couple of shots in particular, and then I want to get to a specific technique that they use. The robed figures holding the lanterns over the bridge, I think it is just gorgeous. The music right then is really starting to hit with the Ave Maria.
Yeah.
And that image, to me, is one of the most beautiful images Disney's ever produced.
Mm-hmm. But when they're on the bridge?
They're walking over the bridge.
Okay, yeah. I was even going to go just a little bit before that, before they get to the bridge and they're walking by the water, their reflection in the water as they're walking, it's just gorgeous. Yeah. And then, yeah, you get to them on the bridge and you don't see their lanterns very bright on the bridge, but in the water, the reflection of their lanterns is gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's a different reflection technique or device that we see in other Disney films. Mm-hmm. This one had a more realistic kind of feel to it, even though everything that you're seeing is, you know, totally supernatural. The final shot of the film is really a feat and a half, and it took hours to complete the shot because it was a tracking shot that they did in a basement. You know, going through all the different panes of animation. And actually, the first time they did it, there was a minor earthquake.
Oh, wow.
And just because of that tiny little shake, they had to redo the entire sequence again. They had to shoot it twice, and it took hours to do this. There's something very, very... to me, this is the most elegant shot ever in an animated film. This long shot tracking through the forest as Ave Maria is climaxing, and we get that sunrise at the end, which, if you remember, is very akin to how the film starts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Remember I was saying before how we get that idea with Stokowski raising his hands at a sunrise?
Yeah.
Well, now we've reached the beginning of, like, the end of another day, almost, or the beginning of another day. This also uses focal points extremely well. You know, that sense of depth by putting certain things out of focus, certain things in focus, which if you look at a modern day or maybe one of the earlier CGI films, CGI animation, nothing did that. They didn't really do that because a computer wants everything to look perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't until WALL-E that they really, really messed with that. But they had to basically trick the computer into not working.
Yeah, they had to rewrite the programming to be
like
this
fool
needs
it.
To be out of focus.
To fool it to like not fix it.
Yeah.
And this is, to me, this almost looks photorealistic when we're going through those trees near the end. It looks like you could be walking through it.
Yeah.
It is my favorite finale. The movie could not have ended on any other shot than this shot. It's really expertly put together. That's my gushing over this sequence because I think it is an absolute masterpiece. For me, it is the highlight of the film. Yeah. I love The Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's a classic to me. And if I was to try to show somebody one sequence, that would probably be the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the second one that I really want to show first would be this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's the most that's the most recognizable the most commercial, I guess. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but I think that it's Night at Bull Mountain.
The word
Bull
you're Mountain looking for is the answer. It's the most iconic.
I didn't want to say it.
No, it's the most iconic.
And then, but Night on Bull Mountain is the That I think the that's best, the best sequence.
I think that's the gem of the film. Oh, definitely. Is Night on Bald Mountain. So let's go into our three questions. Let's hit the first one. We don't usually do this one first, but let's do it first. What is the iconic shot of this film? It's Mickey, right? The Sorcerer Mickey? Is it that?
I don't know. I feel like there could be so many, because when I initially think Fantasia, I don't necessarily go straight towards Sorcerer Mickey.
Really?
Yeah.
I do. I do. I would say it's either the Mickey on the mountaintop with the finger up, and then the, like I said before, the scene where he's kind of dancing and leading the broom with the two buckets.
Out of those two, I would lean with the mountaintop.
No, yeah, me too. Because that's the kind you also see. I've seen statues or busts, whatever they call them, of that shot. Yeah, oh, that's right.
I have a few.
I'm like, actually, I think I've seen it a few times. Yeah. But
a number of them.
Yeah, to me, that's the most iconic.
Even in
shot.
Art, even the art pieces that we have.
Yeah, yeah.
He's doing that specific pose.
Yeah.
So let's hold off on you for a second. Scott, what would yours be?
Mine is Mickey Mouse, but it's not Apprentice Mickey Mouse.
Oh.
It's the scene you said before with the conductor.
The shaking of Leopold Stokowski's hand.
Tugging on his... No, even before that, when he's tugging on his...
On his coattails. Okay.
Yeah. That's... I don't know why. It reminds me of the statue that's in the Disneyland, right? The Mickey and Walt, where they're holding hands.
Wait, you mean the partner
The partner
statue?
Statue.
Yeah.
Well, that's in Disney World and Disneyland.
Right. Well, that it reminds me of...
Okay.
Of that.
Because he's in proportion to a human.
Right.
Yeah.
He's in the real world.
Right.
Is that the first time Mickey's been in the real
Actually,
world?
Actually, I was just going to... Yeah, I think that might have been.
I think that is. I don't know if he was ever in a mixed real live-action
animation thing.
That might be the very first time.
I think that has to be the first
done
time.
It. He hasn't done it much. No. They haven't done that much with that character.
No.
Melissa, what would your iconic shot be? There's no winner in this, by the way. We just
no, of course there is. I already said it, but you can. No, I know. You can go.
I'm always the odd one out.
No, I'm actually going to be odd.
Well, I don't know. When I think Fantasia, the initial thing that I think of is actually the dancing mushrooms. Just that little scene when they first, like when you first go to them, they're not animated yet, but they're just in that circle. Or even when they're closing on it and they go back into that circle with the little one in the middle.
Okay.
I don't know. That's what I always think of.
That's the thing that sticks out to
you.
Yeah. For me, man, I own the most Sorcerer Mickey things of anything. But if you say the words Fantasia to me, the first thing I think of is Chernabog on that mountain.
Yeah.
It really is. And I think slowly he is becoming, in popular art and whatnot, the B to the A, which is Mickey, Sorcerer Mickey in that film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You see him represented the most.
Yeah.
For me, it is that. Even though, in reality, for the masses, it's Sorcerer Mickey. It's not an argument.
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
That is the consensus, would be Sorcerer Mickey. But for me personally, it's Chernabog. But for everything else that I know of, because seriously, my two favorite characters in Disney animated films are Sorcerer Mickey and Chernabog.
Yeah.
Dude, that's my top two.
Yeah.
So I would go with Chernabog personally, just because art off of that character is out of this world.
Yeah.
And that shot is so much. It's so much. It is an absolute piece of art in its own. Let's go towards what is the heart of the film? Is there a moral lesson, or is this simply something that is trying to elicit an emotion out of the watcher? If you don't mind, I'll go first. I think this one is pretty, this is pretty cut dry. This is an emotion film. This is meant to get every emotion out of you through the different sequences. The only moral I could imagine is don't screw with the magic hat.
Yeah, don't live in that town with Chernabog.
And don't be a dinosaur.
Don't be a dinosaur.
Don't be a dinosaur.
No.
Does anyone disagree with that? Does anyone think that this is more a morals film than something that is just meant to get, like a piece of art?
Yeah.
You know, an abstract piece of art, a Pollock. That is not a morals thing, but everyone can look at it and get a different kind of emotion from it.
Yeah.
And I think, what?
I just thought of Daredevil when he was looking at the white painting.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that one day. Okay. I'm going to literally just stand in front of a Pollock painting for hours until a Italian curator asks me if I want to buy it.
All right.
I'll be like, no.
Mm-hmm.
I just like it. Mm-hmm. Or however you can talk.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely emotions. I don't
know. Brian?
No,
Scott.
No, go ahead. No, you go.
Do we have dissent?
I see a lot of, a good portion of them do have that moral tale, good versus evil, bad versus, you know, whatever. But overall, I think it's an emotion. Okay. As if you break it down by sequence, I think it'll change, but the whole Fantasia as a whole is definitely emotion.
Okay. Brian?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely just, everyone has said before, it's like a piece of art. It's supposed to elicit an emotional response in you, and everyone might take different things from different scenes, but that's all the overall goal of it is to,
okay, you know. And now, finally, does this film hold up? Melissa?
It's hard because it is broken into sequences. I think certain sequences...
As a whole.
Hold up as a whole. I think the majority can outweigh the one sequence that's a little meh. I think overall, yeah. I think it's, you know, the techniques, the animation, everything still is beautiful. There's, of course, the techniques that we don't even know what they did or, mm-hmm. you know, few know what they did. I think as a cinematography, you know, standpoint, it's beautiful. So I think it holds up.
Scott, same question?
I think it does for an adult audience. I don't think it would be very good for children.
I actually agree with that. Brian?
Yeah, actually, I agree with that also. I definitely think it holds up 100%. I would love to. I love the 3D idea. I would love to see that.
Oh, my God.
Even the re-release in the theaters, I would go see that again. I definitely think it holds up.
I also believe this film holds up immensely. I know Rite of Spring is a very, like, ugh. It is a slog through the mud, like literally.
Yeah.
But I that doesn't lessen the effect, the incredible effectiveness of every other sequence.
Yeah.
It has created an iconic image for a character. It has created multiple iconic images out of one film.
Yeah.
That Disney still uses to this day in a lot of things.
Yeah.
So I think without doubt, this film ages beautifully. This is one of the movies I always get excited if I meet somebody who never watched it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is one I'm like, oh, you got to come over. You got to see this. And I'll be honest, I'll skip Rite of Spring.
Yeah. The nice thing about DVDs now, we can just skip it.
I would literally skip over it because I do think that loses the audience a little bit.
You know what?
It's just a bit much.
When we had said that they cut it down to 88 minutes. What did they cut out? Do we know? Is that something they cut out? Like the Rite of Spring?
No, I don't. I honestly
do. You think they just might have cut certain sequences down instead of cutting things out?
Man, that's really hard to do with music. That's a 25-minute thing. So even if they fully excise that, you'd still have to find 12 more minutes.
Well, yeah. The intermission. Then you wouldn't need the intermission.
I guess so. That's a 15-minute intermission, if I remember. Sure. So. I don't think so. I don't know if they excised an entire thing. Yeah, we didn't read it. We should have, but we apologize that we did not. But we are almost reaching an hour and a half, so let's. We really got to change the title of this show to the 90-minute show. Let me first say thank you, and let me get a read on those reviews, because we were very nice enough to have two more people go on to the iTunes and review us. And as I continue to speak in a very long-winded manner in order to bring this up on the hello page. Bah, sorry, I hit the microphone, folks. This is from DMB Anthony. I have a feeling I know who this is. Mm-hmm. One of the best Disney podcasts, listening to Pete, Brian, Melissa, and Scott is like catching up with old friends week after week, talking about my favorite topic, Disney. Informative, fun, and thought-provoking show. I must listen. Thank you very, very much. I can't believe I didn't stumble over any of that. Because I usually do whenever I try to read things.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you very much. And we had one just last night. Awesome Disney show from jcrump320. And it just says, fun show, highly recommended. Thank you very, very much. So huge thank you to everybody who has gone on there. It's funny, I'm in a little podcaster group. And the topic of how it's impossible to get reviews was a post by somebody. And I was like, wow, okay, it's not just us.
No. It's just, I think, the nature of the thing.
The film basement, we're almost at 50.
I know, we're
almost there. I told you, you've got to start slapping Brian.
I can't slap him on this show.
No, I can't.
Show.
Can I slap him?
You can slap him, yeah. Okay. If you guys give a review, a 5-star review of the show, and say, Walt approved, okay? Well, I want Walt approved in the header. If you do that, I'm going to let Melissa... hit Brian across the face. She just agreed to it. Now, Brian does this for the other show.
Oh, I didn't say across the face.
Just hit him?
Yeah.
Okay, she's going to...
She's gonna slap me across the face, folks.
All yeah, right. She's gonna slap me across the face. It's a light slap.
It's light. It'll be a.
We'll have glitter on her hand.
Yes.
All right. So we'll have glitter on her hand.
You know, maybe we'll do that. I'll let you give me I don't know. You can the throw glitter on my face. Yeah.
Okay. All right. No. She. Oh, what is you that get called? To antique him. Can't do that. That's a little much.
No, yeah. No. No.
Don't no I meant with the glitter, like.
Glitter bomb?
Yeah.
Glitter bomb, yeah. I don't know where that is.
I forgot. I wear my glasses that day.
So if you guys do that, Walt approved, give us a 5-star review. We will throw glitter at Brian. And I will take photos of it and I will post it on the site. So
we'll sprinkle pixie dust on him.
Yes, for every 5-star review, don't worry about the header. For every 5-star review that we get by next week, we will throw glitter at Brian. A handful of glitter for every review. And then I have to buy Brian a vacuum. Okay. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight, guys. You're listening to The Trouble by Pogo. You can find his videos over on youtube.com/Pogo, his music at soundcloud.com/Pogo Mix, and his web address is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. That's G-E-N, as in, you know, last generation. You can find us on Twitter at our new handle at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S. Magic Hour Pod, P-O-D. On Facebook, you can join our group. Just search for Disney Magic Hour, and we will pop up there. And as I said, please head on over to iTunes. Hit that subscribe. 5-star review. Glitter thrown on Brian. Everybody wins, especially Brian.
Yes.
So, say goodnight, Brian.
Goodnight, Brian.
Say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Pete. Say goodnight, Pogo.